This
Art House Radio.
Live from Detroit. Welcome to
Art House Radio.
Conceptual art had never really bent on collapsing the very institutions, the art galleries, museums, collectors, through which their nature must be communicated. There are those who wrongly perceive conceptualism as having had such an ambition, and who declare the entire enterprise to have been co-opted because it necessarily remained thoroughly within the art system. The conduct of ideological activities in the real world can always be virtuous, always be politically correct, in quotation marks, simply by being exercised through head-on confrontation with an opposing ideology. In the 1960s, conceptual activity assumed a dialectical stance towards various art world ideologies because head-on confrontation would have failed to produce any effective discourse, thereby rendering it a non-issue. That is Douglas Hubler in 1982 talking about conceptual art. That is from Tony Godfrey's book, Conceptual Art, which I love, and I thought, why not have a brief fireside chat where I open the book and I read a random page that makes no sense at all. Welcome to Art House Radio. I am your host, Troy Ramos. I'm glad to have you with me. Are you having a good day? I hope that you're enjoying the start of fall, the march towards Halloween, the march towards the worst witch, Mike Myers, Freddy, Jason. Why is it about that anyway? Shouldn't it be more about witches? When did all of a sudden mass murderers and serial killers get involved? Maybe they've always been involved. I don't know. This is episode 125. There is a guy named Simon Sinek who has been breaking the internet, apparently. And I only discovered him in the last few days. I'm not sure how that happened, but I know that you know, sometimes things happen that you aren't aware of, especially if you're like me and you sort of tune out to a lot of things that are happening in the news world. And so I saw this YouTube speech or conversation between two guys, one of them Simon Sinek. I hope I'm saying that right, by the way. Simon Sinek. And it said over 250 million views. And we're going to replay the speech or discussion that broke the internet. So they re-released it, and they got several million views, of course. You know, I don't know why you'd re-release it. If you already got 250 million, you know, why do you have to be like Sam Jackson? Sam Jackson being a movie star, and then he has to do Capital One commercials. Can't you let somebody else have a little time? Just play the original video. It's already got 250 million views, according to them. So I'm not sure why they have to re-release it. Nevertheless, I'm going to follow their pattern and play you a clip of this here because it starts out talking about millennials and it kind of morphs into, he doesn't go off topic, but it does have something to do with technology and our addiction to our devices. I think there's a lot of great things in here, and I think it has 250 million views or millions of views because there's a lot of things that resonate with people in here. And I don't mean to be one of those people who finds a few things that I'd like to bring up that I didn't really like or that I question. But I'm gonna, because it's my show and I can do whatever the fuck I want. So here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna do something a little bit different. Normally I would talk for a bit and then play the clip, but I'm going to play the clip first of Simon Sinek on millennials. And then I'm going to come back and just point out a few things, not that he didn't think of, but the things that I like that he's doing, but also could I just add to that, and things that I maybe didn't quite understand or that I question about this, his ideas. Not personal attacks, just interesting, flavorful, meaningful, constructive I don't even want to say criticism, thoughts, just spilling out of my fat Cool Ranch Doritos hole into your ears and for people's listening pleasure. So let's go to this clip of Simon Sinek having a conversation. He's asked a question about millennials, and he goes into it. It's about 15 minutes long, so lay back, grab a glass of whiskey, and I will see you on the other side.
I have yet to give a speech or have a meeting where somebody doesn't ask me the millennial question.
What's the millennial question?
Apparently, millennials as a generation, which is a group of people who were born approximately 1984 and after, are tough to manage. And they're accused of being entitled and narcissistic, self-interested, unfocused, lazy. But entitled is the big one. And because they confound leadership so much, what's happening is leaders are asking the millennials, what do you want? And millennials are saying, we want to work in a place with purpose, love that. We want to make an impact, you know, whatever that means. We want free food and beanbags. And so somebody articulates some sort of purpose. There's lots of free food and there's beanbags. And yet, for some reason, they are still not happy. And that's because they're missing, there's a missing piece. What I've learned is that I can break it down into four pieces, right? There are four things, four characteristics. One is parenting, the other one is technology, the third is impatience, and the fourth is environment. The generation that we call the millennials, too many of them grew up subject to, not my words, failed parenting strategies, you know? Where, for example, they were told that they were special all the time. They were told that they could have anything they want in life, just because they want it, right? They were told, some of them got into honors classes, not because they deserved it, but because their parents complained. And some of them got A's, not because they earned them, but because the teachers didn't want to deal with the parents. Some kids got participation medals. You got a medal for coming in last. Right? Which the science we know is pretty clear, which is it devalues the medal and the reward for those who actually work hard, and it actually makes the person who comes in last feel embarrassed because they know they didn't deserve it, so it actually makes them feel worse. Right? So you take this group of people, and they graduate school, and they get a job, and they're thrust into the real world, and in an instant, they find out they're not special, their moms can't get them a promotion, that you get nothing for coming in last, and by the way, you can't just have it because you want it. Right? And in an instant, their entire self-image is shattered. And so you have an entire generation that's growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations. The other problem, to compound it, is we're growing up in a Facebook, Instagram world. In other words, we're good at putting filters on things. We're good at showing people that life is amazing even though I'm depressed, right? And so everybody sounds tough, and everybody sounds like they got it all figured out. And the reality is there's very little toughness, and most people don't have it figured out. And so when the more senior people say, well, what should we do? They sound like, this is what you gotta do. And they have no clue, right? So you have an entire generation growing up with lower self-esteem than previous generations, right? Through no fault of their own, through no fault of their own, right? They were dealt a bad hand, right? Now let's add in technology. We know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good, right? So, you know, we've all had it where you're feeling a little bit down or feeling a bit lonely, and so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, you know, hi, 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 because it feels good when you get a response, right? Right? It's why we count the likes, it's why we go back 10 times to see if my Instagram is growing slower, did I do something wrong? Do they not like me anymore, right? The trauma for young kids to be unfriended, right? Because we know when you get a hit of dopamine, which feels good. It's why we like it, it's why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive, right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, this adolescence thing, if it gets you down... But that's basically what's happening. That's basically what's happening, right? That's basically what happened. You have an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. And as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe, right? It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains, and for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress, that's pretty much the primary reasons why an alcoholic drinks, right? What's happening is, because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media, basically it's becoming hardwired, and what we're seeing is as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that their friends, that they don't count on their friends, they don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person, they're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook suffer higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. Right? These things balanced. Alcohol is not bad, too much alcohol is bad. Gambling is fun, too much gambling is dangerous. Right? There's nothing wrong with social media and cell phones. It's the imbalance. Right? If you're sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting somebody who's not there, that's a problem. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people you're supposed to be listening to and speaking and you put your phone on the table, face up or face down, I don't care, that sends a subconscious message to the room that you're just not that important to me right now, right? That's what happens. And the fact that you cannot put it away is because you are addicted, right? If you wake up and you check your phone before you say good morning to your girlfriend, boyfriend, or spouse, you have an addiction. And like all addiction, in time, it'll destroy relationships, it'll cost time, and it'll cost money, and it'll make your life worse, right? So you have a generation growing up with lower self-esteem that doesn't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress, right? Now you add in the sense of impatience. right? They've grown up in a world of instant gratification. You want to buy something, you go on Amazon, it arrives the next day. You want to watch a movie? Log on and watch a movie. You don't check movie times. You want to watch a TV show? Binge. You don't even have to wait week to week to week, right? I know people who skip seasons just so they can binge at the end of the season, right? Instant gratification. You want to go on a date? You don't even have to learn how to be like, hey. You don't even have to learn and practice that skill. You don't have to be the uncomfortable one who says yes when you mean no and says no when you mean no and yes when you... You don't have to... Swipe right. Bang, I'm a stud. Right? You don't have to learn the social coping mechanisms. Right? Everything you want, you can have instantaneously. Everything you want, instant gratification. Except job satisfaction and strength of relationships, there ain't no app for that. They are slow, meandering, uncomfortable, messy processes. And so I keep meeting these wonderful, fantastic, idealistic, hardworking, smart kids. They've just graduated school. They're in their entry-level job. I sit down with them and I go, how's it going? They go, I think I'm gonna quit. I'm like, why? They're like, I'm not making an impact. I'm like, you've been here 8 months. You know? It's as if they're standing at the foot of a mountain and they have this abstract concept called impact that they want to have in the world, which is the summit. What they don't see is the mountain. I don't care if you go up the mountain quickly or slowly, but there's still a mountain. And so what this young generation needs to learn is patience, that some things that really, really matter, like love or job fulfillment, joy, love of life, self-confidence, a skill set, any of these things, all of these things take time. Sometimes you can expedite pieces of it, but the overall journey is arduous and long and difficult. And if you don't ask for help and learn that skill set, you will fall off the mountain, or you will, the worst case scenario, and we're already seeing it, the worst case scenario is we're seeing an increase in suicide rates. We're seeing an increase in this generation. We're seeing an increase in accidental deaths due to drug overdoses. We're seeing more and more kids drop out of school or take leaves of absence due to depression. Unheard of. This is really bad. The best case scenario, those are all bad cases, right? The best case scenario is you'll have an entire population growing up and going through life and just never really finding joy. They'll never really find deep, deep fulfillment in work or in life. They'll just waft through life and it'll be just, it's fine. How's your job? It's fine. It's the same as yesterday. How's your relationship? It's fine. Like, that's the best case scenario. Which leads me to the fourth point, which is environment. Which is, we're taking this amazing group of young, fantastic kids who are just dealt a bad hand. It's no fault of their own. And we put them in corporate environments that care more about the numbers than they do about the kids. They care more about the short-term gains than the long-term life of this young human being. We care more about the year than the lifetime, right? And so we are putting them in corporate environments that aren't helping them build their confidence, that aren't helping them learn the skills of cooperation, that aren't helping them overcome the challenges of a digital world and finding more balance, that isn't helping them overcome the need to have instant gratification and teach them the joys and impact and the fulfillment you get from working hard over on something for a long time that cannot be done in a month or even in a year. And so we're thrusting to them in corporate environments, and the worst part about it is they think it's them. They blame themselves. They think it's them who can't deal. And so it makes it all worse. It's not. I'm here to tell them it's not them. It's the corporations. It's the corporate environments. It's the total lack of good leadership in our world today that is making them feel the way they do. They were dealt a bad hand, and I hate to say it, but it's the company's responsibility. Sucks to be you. Like, we have no choice, right? This is what we got, and I wish that society and their parents did a better job. They didn't. So we're getting them in our companies, and we now have to pick up the slack. We have to work extra hard to figure out the ways that we build their confidence. We have to work extra hard to find ways to teach them the social skills that they're missing out on. There should be no cell phones in conference rooms. None. Zero. And I don't mean the kind of like sitting outside waiting to text. I mean, like, when you're sitting and waiting for a meeting to start, this is what we all do. We all sit here and wait for the meeting to start. Meeting starting? Okay. And we start the meeting. No, that's not how relationships are formed. Remember we talked about it's the little things? Relationships are formed this way. We're waiting for a meeting to start, and we go, how's your dad? I heard he was in the hospital. Oh, he's really good. Thanks for asking. He's actually at home now. Oh, I'm really glad. It was really amazing. I know, it was really scary for a while. That's how you form relationships. Hey, did you ever get that report done? Oh my God, no, I didn't. I'll help you out. Can I help you out with that? Really? That's how trust forms. Trust doesn't form at an event, in a day. Even bad times don't form trust immediately. It's the slow, steady consistency. And we have to create mechanisms where we allow for those little innocuous interactions to happen. But when we allow cell phones in conference rooms, we just, okay, have the meeting. And then my favorite is like when there's a cell phone there and you go like this, you go. It rings and you go, I'm not gonna answer that. Like, Mr. Magnanimous, you know? When you're out for dinner with your friends, like, I do this with my friends. When we're going out for dinner and we're leaving together, we'll leave our cell phones at home. Who are we calling? Maybe one of us will bring a phone in case we need to call an Uber or take a picture of our meal.
That's what I was saying. Come on.
I'm an idealist, but I'm not insane. You
know? Not a heathen.
I mean, it looked really good. We'll take one phone. And so it's like an alcoholic. The reason you take the alcohol out of the house is because we cannot trust our willpower. We're just not strong enough. But when you remove the temptation, it actually makes it a lot easier. And so when you just say, don't check your phone, people literally will go like this. And somebody will go to the bathroom, and what's the first thing we do? Because I wouldn't want to look around the restaurant for a minute and a half, you know? But if you don't have the phone, you just kind of enjoy the world. And that's where ideas happen. The constant engagement is not where you have innovation and ideas. Ideas happen when our minds wander and we go, and you see something, maybe they could do that. That's called innovation, right? But we're taking away all those little moments, right? You should not, and none of us should charge our phones by our beds. We should be charging our phones in the living rooms, right? Remove the temptation. You wake up in the middle of the night because you can't sleep, you won't check your phone, which makes it worse. But if it's in the living room, it's relaxed, it's fine. But it's my alarm clock. Buy an alarm clock. They cost $8, right? I'll buy you an alarm clock, right? But the point is we now in industry, whether we like it or not, we don't get a choice. We now have a responsibility to make up the shortfall and to help this amazing, idealistic, fantastic generation build their confidence, learn patience, learn the social skills, find a better balance between life and technology. Because, quite frankly, it's the right thing to do.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Coming on. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now, before I get into this, let me remind you that you can follow us at ArtHouse43, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. Write into me, let me know what kind of an asshole you think I am, or if you think I'm not an asshole. That's always a nice email to get. You can also go to ArtHouse43.com and support us in some way. Send me a personal letter of love or hate or constructive criticism. Now, why am I saying all this? I don't know. Just send me something if you'd like. I'd like to hear what you have to say, especially on a particular episode. Okay, so that was Simon Sinek talking about millennials. I like a lot of what he had to say. And I feel like as you listen to him talk, he makes so much sense because he is someone who's very sure of himself, I think. I think he tries to play it like he's modest, and it doesn't always come off for me that way. I feel like he talks in a lot of generalizations, which I think to a certain extent you have to do if you're going to talk about trying to provide practical solutions, like actually move forward. I mean, at some point, people like me could never run a retail shop or a restaurant because somebody would say, hey, can we turn the lights on over here? And I'd be like, what is light? And people would be like, we need light. The people are leaving. So you need someone like him who will just come in and say, this is how it is. Let's go with it. And then it's easier for other people to criticize it because, you know, when you take a stance on something, you're going to get criticized for it. This podcast is no different because there are a few things, and I just want to go through a couple of things that I liked and maybe didn't like. So the first thing I thought while I was listening to it, when he was talking about how millennials have been dealt this bad deal, okay, I think that there's definitely some truth to that. I think we also could add this to the list of things that millennials get unfairly charged with, and that is, I think most of the world seems to take their frustrations out on millennials because they act like they were the inventors of this machine. You know, and the truth of the matter is that just like citizenship, people can't help where or when they're born. They're just awake. Now they definitely are helping to drive these machines, these devices through apps and creating the technology or contributing towards that for sure. But this is, I mean, you have to go back much further if you're going to blame somebody for the technocracy that is at our feet. By the way, I also would say that I don't know that millennials would be anyone born around 1984. I think it'd be a little later than that. That's my person. Because anyone born around 1984, those people remembered time before internet quite significantly too. I mean, it wasn't only maybe until late high school when people who were born in the mid 80s started to get an internet sensation on their fingertips. So I would say late 80s for sure, maybe early 90s. If you were born, I'd say maybe like what? 93-ish? Let's go with 93. I think that's a little more accurate because I don't think someone born in 1984 can actually identify with someone who was born in 1993. I think those are two different worlds. They're always different worlds, but especially in this context where you're talking about how every couple of years matter in technology. All right, so here's the second thing. He says people are learning to turn to a device as a coping mechanism for stress. I think he's definitely right. Okay. We all do it, right? We just don't do it as bad as some other people. There are always people who take it too far and they put up like, you know, dramatic posts about this or that. Yeah, that's definitely true that that's happening. But he suggests that, you know, turning to friends is the way to go. I would totally agree with that. That's a better way to go. My question would be, is there really a better coping mechanism? I mean, relying on friends might be better, but why do we accept that we continued on a path which requires coping mechanisms? We accept that financial, job, or social stress must occur. Occur? What am I, Welsh? He seems to feel like the system that we have is unchangeable. Maybe not unchangeable, but he seems to be dealing with the symptoms and not the cause, is what I'm trying to say. Now, I think if he were sitting here, and it would be awesome to have him here, but if you're sitting here, he would talk circles around me, so I probably wouldn't even be able to get this in, but I think he would argue, yes, Troy, of course it would be great if everybody could lay on the beach and sip lemonade from a curly straw. Do they have curly straws? Fun straws? What are they called? Ugh, I can't remember. Tweet at me, at Arthouse43, if you can remember what the kind of those fun straws were that curl all around. He would say, yes, that would be awesome to have those types of straws, the name for which seems to have given you trouble. But that's not how the world works. So the world works this way. How are you going to cope with it? I think that's exactly what Hitler would have said. I think he would have said, look, it would be awesome if everybody were just like consciousness blobs floating around and we all got along, whatever. That's not how it works. So this is how it's going to work. And this is the way I cope with things. This is what I have as a vision for the world. So I'm going to accept the structure and then try to do my best on top of it. I get that, but I think that's also enabling that structure, contributing towards it. And to me, that doesn't make sense. I mean, wouldn't he say, if you had a business and you had a problem within that business, that you don't deal with the symptom of it, you go to the source of it, and you change it, and you change whatever you need to change to make things flow better? Well, why would you suggest that having any sort of coping mechanism, even if it's the best one, as some sort of solution? Is it maybe as like a temporary patch until you go back and figure out, wait a minute, hold on, why are we accepting that this is reality? And this sort of runs into something that I'll talk about later, but he seems very sure that he has a lot of answers. And I was talking with somebody last week about this. I don't really like people who have answers. And it's not because I like chaos. I'm not a goth. I don't like to sit around and hate on people who are happy. I want people to be successful. I just question certain kinds of success or the means by which they achieve them or the system in which it is achieved. The questions are more important than the answers. I'm sure of it. And that's kind of an answer in itself, which makes it weird. But, again, I like the idea that he has something to say, which I think you need to do, but not all the time. It seems like if you asked him something, he would ponder it and sort of like, even if he tiptoed around it, he would eventually go in there with some sort of sales pitch about how this has to work. And again, I'm not saying that I didn't like most of what he had to say. He was right about this. And the third thing he's right about is the addiction part. I don't know that it's feasible to have age restrictions, but he's right. If gambling and alcohol are addictive substances or, just activities, then there are age limits on them, smoking including, why wouldn't we limit apps or social media sites or devices? I think that's actually a great idea. The problem is enforcing it. I mean, look at the war on drugs. You can't just tell people, like, don't smoke weed. It'll make you crazy and it'll make you rape white girls. Because that's pretty much what William Randolph Hearst, probably one of the biggest assholes of the 20th century, you know, not the biggest, because I can think of a couple more, but certainly one of the biggest assholes of the 20th century who, you know, put that fear out there of like people of let's just say poor backgrounds, smoking weed and going crazy, getting that madness. You know, I forget where I was going with this. So, but yeah, the addiction part, I think he's right, but you can't enforce it. Oh yeah, right. The drugs. People smoked anyway. That's the point. Now we've got like, what, 13 states that are legal in some ways, and then another 10 or so that are medical. You can't stop it. Same thing with phones. You're not going to be able to stop it. It's already out there. Just like you're not going to be able to round up all the guns. Never going to happen. Never going to get it. Never going to get it. Never going to get it. So, yeah, I think he's a great speaker, and he's got a lot of other videos where he talks about really interesting things about leadership and what people follow and how they follow, why you do things and not what and how you do them. That it's just that simple twist of things. But I think the speaking in generalizations, especially in this video when he talks at the end, like how millennials are this or that, and then he says, but I this path will mean that they won't find joy, that they won't find job satisfaction. You don't know that. How do you know that? You're acting like millennials are a robot type that gets just sort of like pressed and they're all the same. They're different. And first of all, if there's ever a generation that doesn't have job satisfaction, I think they're pretty spot on. I mean, who wants to be in a fucking cubicle? Some people, it depends on what you do, right? So if you're in a cubicle and you think it's meaningful to you and it's significant and you like it, you like the people you work with, great, that's awesome. But when you force people to do that, there's going to be a lot of them who aren't going to like it. A lot of people are not going to want to spend their days eating their break in the lunchroom at Circuit City. Okay, that's just not their idea of fun. And I can't say that they're wrong. So to tell people that like they're just not going to find any job satisfaction, or hey, they've only been at a job for 8 months and they haven't made an impact. I think if you haven't made an impact at a job in 8 months, or you feel like it's not the right job for you, I think that's plenty of fucking time. So I don't know what he's talking about with that, and then the finding joy. Has he found joy? That's the question I would ask him. And by the way, I want to just reiterate that I'm having a conversation with somebody who's not here, so I'm not trying to, I don't want to criticize too much, because I think he has a lot of great ideas, a lot of great suggestions. But I think you need to back off the generalization thing, because everybody's different. All millennials, every single person has their own likes and dislikes. We're all being shuffled into this one path, sort of, what do they call that, kettling, or what's it called, where they shoehorn people into one thing? Is that what they call it? Just fed, like, I can't even think today. You have a kid in a classroom who wants to go out and play with the trees and dig things up and learn and hold a worm and look at it and think about science, maybe. Maybe that's what that leads to. But instead, he's being told to sit there, shut up, and read this dumb Edgar Allan Poe short story. I'm not saying Edgar Allan Poe is dumb, but to him it is. So why would you force him to do that? Why would you force him to do algebra? Why would you force him to not split his infinitives? Do you like that? He doesn't give a fuck about that. So why do we expect that if people can't like if that the goal is to have everybody work in a cubicle or a restaurant or at the mall and be 100% happy, that's not going to fucking happen. It's never going to happen. Because people aren't robots. Not yet, anyway. We like to go to the woods. We like to lay in the grass. We like to be lazy. We like to sleep in. We do like to work hard. I think a lot of people enjoy whatever work it is that they do. They have, you know, some people have unrealistic things. They go to open mic stand-up comedy things, and they're terrible. They're never going to make it, and they have this delusion that they're going to. Sure, whatever. But it's their fucking life. They should be allowed to try different things. And just because people don't find joy in their work, it doesn't make them a failure. It could be the system is a failure. And furthermore, this is my sixth point, why is it the corporation's or employer's job to nurture anyone? He actually said in there, in that clip, if you remember, he says, it's the corporations. It's like that South Park episode where they were like, it's the corporations, man. Look, the corporations are terrible, and they make us do lots of things through advertising, through, you know, what do you call them? Like the mortgage thing, the mortgage crisis. What was the name of that thing? You know, bills, whatever it is, they corner us and we get in there. Student loans, so we have to play their game. Yes, they're terrible, but we always have a choice. We always have a choice, and every time we vote with our pocketbook or we reject that we're trapped and we feel like we have an option to get out of whatever situation we are in, then we have the leverage. It's not the employer's job to nurture and suckle millennials. Like there's some sort of like helpless blob of a child at 23 that comes into the office and like the employer is supposed to breastfeed them while reading them Dr. Seuss books. That's not their fucking job. They have a business to run. It's the job of the millennials. You can't let them off the hook. Like I'm talking about them like there's some sort of similar being that's been reproduced on an assembly line. They're all different. I mean, you can't let anyone escape personal responsibility. You can't go up to them and say, "Likutz, I know that you're 400 pounds, but it's not your fault. You're fat. It's the sugar fat." Salt combo that Ronald McDonald and the Faygo supporting Juggalos made you drink and eat. It's the clowns, man. We got to get rid of the clowns. No, it's you. Ultimately, it's you. I think this is just another way of somebody who's probably giving tours and has great insight and definitely has me writing down quotes of what he's saying. And I don't make this too much about him because it's not about him. It's about a larger issue. But I really wish that we could address the root problems and not the sort of surface/symptom problems, because I think that's not going to get us anywhere. I think coping with the system that we have is going to make that system thrive and push us even further, and pretty soon we won't be able to cope. We'll all be like Amy Winehouse, not able to handle this beast we've created. That's going to happen, and there's not going to be a damn thing that anyone like Steve Sinek or Eckhart Tolle or Ram Dass sitting out in his retreat in Hawaii in the weeds just off the edge of the water coming in on the beach, chanting all day long. Like, he doesn't have to go to Staples for a 4-10 shift and listen to some dumbass who's his manager tell him what to do. You know, let's see your be here now when you're working a 4-10 shift at Long John Silver's. And I'm not trying to be a smartass and like confront them, in an unfair way, but these are fair questions to ask. We're going to have to get to the root of things at some point. We can't keep dancing around it, because it feels like sometimes a lot of people, or too many people, are in some sort of a trance. And if you just sort of give them ways to deal with the system, yeah, it's going to alleviate them in the short term, but in the long term, what's going to happen to us?